Hey listeners, Chloe here. If you need to stay as up to date with the latest developments and innovations in the luxury industry as I do, you need to dive into Vogue Business. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Just visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code RUN20 at checkout to join the Vogue Business community. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code RUN20. Don't miss out. This is The Run-Through. I'm Chloe Mel.
And I'm Cher Minardi. And what a show we have for you today. Oh my God, I can't believe it, but we've got Marc Jacobs.
My jaw fell to the floor when I found out that he said yes to this. And he was here in the flesh. I saw his security badge ID photo.
I can't wait to listen to this interview. And just
I know,
get
I heard it was
deep into it.
Quite a blockbuster interview. We have Nicole Phelps, our Vogue Runway colleague, right here in the flesh with us also today. And it is right on the eve of New York Fashion Week. So Nicole has many important things to be doing. But Nicole, tell us about what Marc was like. And also, you just went to the show on Friday evening.
He started posting about his 40th anniversary in January.
Oh,
so
my God.
We were all, you know, we all had a hunch that it would be a big, big moment. But of course, Marc Jacobs shows are always really big. And it was a show that really pushed limits in terms of silhouette and, of course, in terms of those insane bouffant wigs and the clown shoes that some of the models were wearing. And the set was punctuated by this art piece, a giant folding table and chair by this artist named Robert Therian. Mm. And so big that the models walked under it as they came out from backstage. And the vibe felt sort of like a dollhouse. I think, you know, a 40th anniversary is a really big deal. And I think he's been thinking a lot about what he's
finding
done in
his
40s.
Inner child.
Yes, finding his inner child, what he's accomplished in these 40 years and what he still wants to do. He's not done with fashion yet. He has more to say.
And we got to talk about the big hair. It does feel like suddenly like beauty is the moment, right? In these shows.
This doll beauty.
It's doll beauty. The doll skin, now the doll hair.
Well, it's also Dita Blair hair, but to each his own.
But also think about Miley Cyrus at the Grammys.
Yes.
I know.
I think something's changing. I feel
higher the hair, the closer to God. Big, almost regal display at the Dune premieres around the world.
I know.
What a gift for those of us who pray at the altar of Zendaya and Timothée and Florence Pugh. They were really turning it out across the globe.
And it was so nice to see, you know, young British design talent represented on the carpet, because I think it is hard as a young designer to get, like, to get a word in edgeways with the red carpet, because, you know, obviously you're competing with these big brands. It was so refreshing to see Florence Pugh in Standing Ground, which is a kind of almost semi-couture brand in the UK by this young designer, Michael Stewart, who's amazing. She wore this long, very fluid white dress that was gathered. And what's so special about Michael's work is that it's all very textures, and he embeds these, I think they're almost like beads, into the dresses. So it has this almost like a spinal feel.
Everything about Zendaya's outfit.
Yeah, I mean, Zendaya's look was pretty incredible. It was like this beautiful crop top and high slit skirt that had these padded details along the shoulder, and it was in different shades of gray and black and red. And then there were these circular details on the skirt too. And it felt very kind of futuristic almost. It felt very Dune-like. And
totally. For me, it was like Volcano, but make it fashion.
It was, exactly.
And who is this designer, Choma? People were very excited, but I was not familiar with them.
Yeah, young British, Nigerian, Brazilian designer by the name of Torishiju Dumi. And she presented her collection in Paris, actually, her debut. So a lot of people, they were all eyes on her then. I think it was last season, if I'm correct. And so we're all kind of looking forward to what she does next. And that's what we love about Zendaya and La Roche, who works with her on her fashion looks. I mean, she's so fearless with what she wears, and she can pull off the most amazing look.
She really can pull off anything, but actually takes advantage of that.
Yeah.
And then exciting news for the Vogue office earlier this week was that Zac Posen is now the creative director of Gap, which everyone was not expecting to hear.
No, from wedding dresses to white t-shirts. Let's see what he does.
Oh, look at you, Choma. You wrote that. The headline writes itself. Choma, we're so excited to see you here in a few days. Any plans besides shows for your big New York City trip?
I feel like there's not going to be much time for anything but shows.
What are you excited about? Which shows?
I'm excited for Proenza. I'm excited to see Diotima. I'm not here for the entire run, but it's always nice to get a kind of feel for New York.
A taste of New York Fashion Week.
Taste of New York Fashion Week. How about you?
I think same thing. I'm excited to... I'm excited for Altuzarra's 15th anniversary. He's having a very intimate small show. Joseph sent out all the invitations himself. I always love a Michael Kors show because they feel like a big sort of event.
Tory's always fun.
Oh, I love Tory shows.
I'm sad to be missing. I'm not going to be able to see my dear friend Batsheva or Raul Lopez's Luar show. They're closing out the week, aren't they? But yeah. I'm sure they'll be amazing.
And Willie Chavaria, everyone here is very excited
gosh,
about.
Oh, Willie, how could we forget?
Yes, there's a lot of excitement about that.
The run through will be back in just a moment with Mark Jacobs.
Get balanced or thrive trying. My name is Les, and I'm the host of Balanced Black Girl, a podcast dedicated to helping you feel your best. Join me for casual conversations about what it means to live a well-rounded life. I cover everything from how to make friends as an adult, to how to create a workout routine that works for you, to how to practice better financial wellness. Tune in for approachable conversations with wellness thought leaders and inspiring guests, as well as intimate solo chats with me for relatable advice. Follow wherever you get your podcasts and look out for new episodes every Tuesday.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? Maybe a chef-grade range made you want to hone your cooking skills, or a high-tech tennis racket made you want to work on your backhand. I recently bought a new pair of running shoes, and that made me love hitting the pavement again. Well, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
And we're back. I think we should just dive right into Nicole and Mark's convo, right? I mean, I'm very excited to hear this.
Yes, let's dive right in.
I am here with Mark Jacobs, who is coming off a fabulous show last Friday. You probably saw it all over your Instagram feeds over the weekend because the pictures were incredible and it was a milestone moment, Mark's 40th anniversary in fashion. So, Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
So congratulations on your anniversary. I want to start off by talking about the fact of 40 years. It's a real milestone. How does it feel? And, you know, longevity is something we talk about a lot. It's not easy to achieve. How does it feel this moment?
I have so much to say on this subject. First of all, I don't think me and the design team, we weren't really worried, concerned, thinking about this anniversary. I mean, there are other things going on within the company to celebrate the 40th anniversary, which will come soon. But we just thought, like we do with every season, we've got to work on a collection and a show. And during the process, there may have been, you know, things that came up that reminded me and us of this big birthday. And I go down memory lane very easily. And so, of course, thinking about all these years and how it started and what was first, like this was a first for me. It started all with a sweater, and then this was the first bag we ever designed, and this was the first time we did the, you know. So I think the knowing of the anniversary triggered me into thinking about these kind of firsts or collections that I always appreciated, and yeah.
And so you did this collection of pieces that it was sort of like an Easter egg experience for all of us, triggering our own memories. So I wasn't familiar with the artist Robert Theron, the sculptor who made these pieces.
Yes.
And it was a giant folding chair, a folding table, mm-hmm. and a chair at the back of the runway.
And four folding chairs.
Four. And so how did you encounter his work? And I'm curious, did it spark the dollhouse aspect of the clothes?
So the first time I saw a piece by Robert was at the Broad in Los Angeles, and it's a wooden dining table. And I mean, as an art collector and art lover, I experience what I call a primitive connection to certain works. And I can't really articulate it as well as I'd like to, but I get this sensation and this feeling like of home, like some kind of comfort. That's, you know, that's what I loved about this dining table. I just looked up at it with wonder. And I think since this show has happened, I've read a couple of things by different journalists, and they've pointed out what my wonder is. And it is that of a young person who looks up two things, whether it's his mother getting dressed or whether it's the scale of a piece of furniture, with kind of awe.
And for people who weren't there, I think we should talk about sort of the perspective skewing nature of what happened. These pieces are so big that the models could literally walk underneath them. And so it sort of did something to your eye as you watched them from the back of the runway come at you. They looked like almost in miniature a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a very long runway.
Yes, it was from Park Avenue or Lexington to Park.
Very long.
Yeah, which I liked. I don't know. I thought of the sculpture also in relation to the space in which we put it. And the armory is so enormous. I mean, what I always find luxurious about showing there is this idea of creating a very, very intimate show in the center of this enormous space. It's a city block, you know, all the way around, and a big city block. I find emotionally that working that way or showing that way creates a kind of emotion for me of, like, again, being very small, because the surrounding is so huge. And I kind of like that feeling. Again, I think we talk about age or time passing and all that stuff. I always wish I could look at things now the way I did when I was like a 9-year-old kid who couldn't wait to get back to school clothes, because everything was so monumental.
Is part of the point of what you're doing trying to get us to feel that sense of wonder too?
I always say, like, I have, you know, 7 minutes or 10 minutes to entertain a group of people that are pretty hard to get to, you know, some of them. Because now I have to say that the audience, I know very few people in that audience. You know, there's a handful or two handfuls of people in that audience of 200 that I know. The rest, with the exception of a few friends, I don't know. I don't know who they are anymore. I don't know who the new editors are or who the influencers are or whatever. So I go about trying to tell this story. And yes, what I'm looking for is some kind of emotional reaction.
In this case, wonder, do you feel, was it a reaction to sort of the world around us, or is it a response to, you know, the state of fashion, the speed with which we are sort of moving through things and consuming things?
Yeah, that's a favorite, like, of the fashion people. Like, oh, it was a response to this and this the world. And, you know, I mean, I might not be very popular for saying this, but, and maybe people will not agree, but I live in a fashion world, right, which is a bubble. And it's a real bubble. It exists within a bigger picture. But it's a tiny little bubble, and I'm okay with that. I mean, my job is to be creative and to share the results of my creativity with this little tiny microcosm of a world. And that's cool. It's great. Does it save, help, or change anything that's going on in the greater world? Absolutely not. But it's contributing something beautiful or interesting. And I think that is benevolent, right? That to me, I mean, I don't need to apologize for not being in cancer research or a politician. You know, those are somebody else's interests and somebody else's jobs. I can do my part as much as possible to be contributing to the good of the world. And I think part of that comes from being creative and putting that creativity out there. It would be wrong to say I'm not influenced by the world at large, because I am. I'm a person in that world, and I see hideous things happening in politics and in all the areas that we know that are just super screwed up. So it does affect me, but I'm not sure it affects the clothes.
Well, your creativity has definitely affected me. And as I was preparing for this, and I was thinking about my earliest Marc Jacobs shows, and I crashed the show, I think it was spring 1998, where you played Bittersweet Symphony. And I felt when I was there that it was exactly where I wanted to be. And I think that you create these kinds of really strong emotional reactions in designers. And I would love to know, do you do your collections for yourself or for your audience?
Okay. So ever since I was a kid, I performed in some way, whether it was bringing home an ashtray I made in the ceramics workshop at summer camp, or I loved to make things. I really do love to make things, and that I do for me. The process of making is for me, but what I make is for the audience. Absolutely, 100%, no doubt about it. I read the reviews. I look to see who's posting now. What I used to say about clothes when we were selling them, you know, to more stores and stuff, is that the ultimate compliment, the completion of the process, is to be on the street and see somebody carrying your bag, wearing your pea coat, whatever. Because, like, without that, your process isn't done. It's just, like, part of the process.
Well, speaking of the street, one thing I have noticed is your tote bags. They really are everywhere. You know, I walk by them. I see young people with them on the subway. And so how does it feel to be sort of back on everybody's lips in the sense that, you know, they're toting around the logo bag with your name on it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful for it. First of all, it really brings a lot of business, you know, and that's, I'm lucky because I couldn't do the show if it weren't for the business that we did with a more democratic priced product. Mm-hmm. And it is very weird for me at my age and having been through so many different things. You know, there was a time where our Venetia bag became extremely popular. It played a role in The Devil Wears Prada. You know, like, it was an iconic kind of it bag when people used to call a bag an it bag. I don't know if they still do that. But I was surprised and shocked that this bag became so popular or is so popular. You know, I couldn't have imagined this happening kind of again. I just felt we'd be like an older, like out of the way kind of brand where other editors my age who've been through this before would relate, but nobody else younger.
Can you think about that a little bit? Because there is, we all accept the fact that, you know, we all age, designers age, and, you know, they do become, you know, the older generation, and it's time for new people to make a mark. But you have a unique ability, proven by this bag, but also proven by the emotions that are triggered, you know, by your shows, of really staying, you know, in the current moment, of the current moment. I mean, how do you manage it?
I struggle, honestly. I struggle with this idea of being relevant, you know, and getting old, or being old, I should say. I'm getting older, but I'm not done. Like, I still want to tell stories and I still want to work in fashion. So even if the world is on to the next younger thing, I just don't want to give up because I'm older. But I do really struggle with it. I mean, I'm on Zoom meetings with my shrink, you know, twice a week, and we talk, you know, a lot about it. And the world has changed so drastically. I never thought I'd be that person who was shocked that, like, somebody 40 doesn't know the references I'm making, and or somebody 20 has no idea of what I'm talking about when I start talking about the things I love or the people who've inspired me. And it's a really strange position to be in. And besides the digital age and my kind of Luddite sensibility to anything electronic or digital or computers, whatever, I don't even know how to refer to it, I sound like what my grandmother would say when she'd say, like, well, in my day.
I guess one thing that makes it okay for me when I think about it is that our references are what make us, right?
Yes, yes, definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. And my memories and my references have great meaning and importance to me. And there are some seasons, I have to say, I think one of the most joyous things about this last show for me is that I felt I didn't have to apologize or hide or feel ashamed of celebrating some of these references. I mean, this time, even when we were doing, like, the hair and makeup, I was like, here's a picture of Dee Dee Ryan, here's a picture of Diana Ross, here's a picture of, you know, Dita Blair. Like, I didn't care. I was like, these are among the references, you know?
Talk about the clothes a little bit in this collection. There was a lot of, I guess you could even say, strange constructions, right? The shapes, the proportions.
Yeah.
What turned you on about those shapes?
We would be in the fitting room and I would look at something. Joseph was working. Joseph is in charge of women's design and he's a great designer. And we worked together for so many years. But I would walk into the fitting room and he'd be in there, and Matt Ryan, who worked with him. And I would see a dumb pencil skirt, but the waistband was like floating about 2 inches away from the body, like front, sides, and back. And I would be like, that's the magic that we want this time. Like, it. I mean, it had hip pads inside. It was bonded to neoprene. There was so much inner construction going on. But when you looked at it, you thought you've got a young lady whose skirt is just floating around her body. And I mean, that excites me. The idea, which we agreed on really from the beginning, was that we wanted to look at kind of basic things, you know, kind of everyday things, either everyday to us throughout our years, or every day, just like what people call classic pieces of clothing, a Shetland sweater, a pencil skirt, a shift, things like that. And we wanted to keep it like a very dressmaker approach, like an old school dressmaker. For me, when I use the word dressmaker, it's like what my grandmother needed a skirt made, she would buy some fabric from Jerry Brown on 57th Street because he had the most beautiful fabrics. And she'd take it to her dressmaker who would make the skirt for her 16 inches from the floor with a 1-inch waistband. Like, she was so specific about it. And I think back to some of our early shows and, you know, that was a word I used to use an awful lot. Like, when we started playing with the scale of buttons and how tiny the shoulder was and the way you set in a sleeve, it was like naive. It was not sophisticated in terms of the make of the clothing. What I think is I'm looking at something very, very simple, and the complexities of it are very beautiful in a way, and that we could kind of carry something off that comes across as like two side seams, you know, but knowing that inside there's this very complicated situation, I guess it's kind of an achievement in a way.
It is, because the pieces, as you say, are simple or simple adjacent, but they're very distinctive because of the sort of the shape and the proportions of them. I think when people see those sweaters, you know, women or men wearing those sweaters, it will be very easy for people to say, oh, yes, Marc Jacobs put those on the runway for spring 2024, because there is this distinctiveness to the pieces.
I wonder, you know, sometimes as someone who buys a lot of fashion or buys some fashion pieces, I know I'm always drawn to the kind of strong piece in a collection.
When you look at the collection that you just put on the runway, what pieces do you think make those statements?
They all made it. I think I'm partial right now to those Shetland sweaters. I think the shape came out particularly well, and they read very well. I liked, there was a black shift that had very large paillettes, and I really love that, because one of the other things we were looking at was this beautiful painting by Alex Katz, and it kind of came as an afterthought. I mean, again, it came up during the process, but it was just all these women, and the painting, his style of painting is so flat, and they were all in a black shift, and I just thought, like, you know, there's nothing better than a good black cocktail dress. Like, it just doesn't get better than that.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
So let's shift a little bit and talk about your generation. And let's talk about pre-grunge. You were a New York kid and at the clubs in the 80s. Can you paint a picture of your Charivari days?
So I got this job at this store that had all this great designer fashion. I mean, that's why I wanted to work there, because I wanted to be around the labels. Like, I wanted to be around Mugler, Gautier, Yohji Yamamoto. Like, it just excited me, right? And I got this job. And then I was going to clubs. I was going to a rock and roll club on the Upper West Side called Hurrah. And I started going to Studio 54 at 16. I was in the High School of Art and Design. I was dressing up, wearing like jumpsuits where it's shoved like three shoulder pads to make it look like it was Mugler, but it was really from Saturday's Generation at Bloomingdale's. And I went through a bunch of looks when I was younger. I mean, I guess I still do that. But yeah, I mean, one day I dyed my hair orange and I was wearing these kind of like futuristic jumpsuits. And the next day I was wearing tiny little bow ties. And then my hair, like, I had my hair super, super long. I started wearing Robert Lee Morris artwear jewelry. At 17, I met Kanzai Yamamoto through my roommate who was working for Robert Lee Morris. Robert Lee Morris was doing the jewelry for Kanzai. Kanzai asked, I was 17, and he asked me if I would be creative and organize some kind of after party, which he typically did after a show. And I was, you know, I was super excited for that opportunity. So I found a fish market on the Upper West Side that would allow me to rent the fish market with the fish in it, because the theme of his collection that season was Kanzai Restaurant. And it had like plastic, transparent plastic pockets, which had like rubber sushi in it. So I had this idea. I made this party, asked Joey Arias, who was a friend of Kansai's, to perform with his group, Strange Party. They played like they pretended they were playing guitar on this huge, huge, enormous fish. It was so weird. And then I made these necklaces out of aquarium tubing with plastic bags, and each one had like a live goldfish that each of the guests got. I mean, it was crazy. You know, so I was very kind of out there. I mean, I was out in New York City, and I was starting to meet people in fashion. And I was very popular at Charivari because all these different people, famous, not famous, would come to me. And I guess it was my energy and my, again, my wonder, my curiosity that just propelled me forward. And I guess that was really attractive to people.
Mm-hmm. Still is.
Hope so.
And you went to Parsons.
I went to Parsons.
To study and get a degree.
Yes. I did not get my degree at Parsons, but I did complete the program.
Right. And you sort of were getting your degree, right, on the streets of New York and at the store. Well, I mean, and I was meeting all these people.
Yeah. One of my teachers, who I liked very much, and I know she was very fond of me too, but sometimes, and I didn't mean it to be, but sometimes she would reply to me like, you are so jaded. And I never thought I was jaded. I just was out there doing a lot of stuff.
So you leave Parsons and very quickly you meet your former business partner, Robert Duffy.
Yes.
And you set up a brand, right?
Yeah. Robert was at that Parsons show. And he was working for a company called Reuben Thomas. It was a Seventh Avenue company who made these very, very dynasty-like dresses, you know, lots of beading, lots of shoulder treatments for a designer called Jonathan Hitchcock. So Robert was working in the showroom, and he was running the showroom, selling these dresses, and it was very successful. But Reuben Thomas wanted to go into what they called the junior market, but it was starting to start up where it was the contemporary market because it was kind of more sophisticated and in a different world than this junior market, you know, which was kind of a 60s, early 70s terminology. So they were looking at different designers to do this, known designers. And then Robert, who they trusted very much, said, let's not take someone known. Let's start a new person and give them a chance to do this. And I just saw someone at Parsons. His name is Mark Jacobs. And I think he should design this new line that we're going to do. So that's how it all started.
And you learned on the job.
Yeah, I learned on the job. I knew nothing about how to do this. They set me up on like a little, like grungy little building. And I didn't know what to do. I was like, how do I find a pattern maker? Where do I make appointments to look at fabrics? Like, I don't know how to do any of this. So I just asked people. And little by little, I had a studio with two seamstresses and one pattern maker and one cutter. And I learned how to do it.
What made you decide to take the Perry Ellis job when you did? Were you a natural fit for it? Were you an unlikely fit?
So I think it always depends on who you ask sort of thing. But Robert McDonald, who was a great friend of Perry's, very close to Perry, was basically, he was running the estate and the design business. And I met Perry when I first started working at Charivari. But briefly, I went up to him as a 16-year-old and I said, oh my God, you're my favorite designer. And what would you suggest I do? Because I really want to pursue this career. And he said, well, my two assistants are at Parsons. That's what I would suggest you do. Go to Parsons. But I used to see Perry once in a while. He lived at the Epitheon, which I was on 72nd Street. And I think that was like one or two blocks over. So once in a while, I'd see him on the street, and he invited me to a show that he did at Saks. I did that. And then this year, cut to years later, he's no longer alive. He's gone. And Robert McDonald, I guess Patricia Pastor and Jed Crisella were Perry's two assistants, both Parsons students. And then Patricia was made like the head of the design at Perry Ellis, of women's design at Perry Ellis. And Robert McDonald was there and being this great friend. And he and Carrie Donovan, who you might want to explain mm-hmm. who she is, they thought I had a certain whimsy in what I was very naively making and showing. And I guess it was Robert who felt that I had the spirit of Perry, maybe not the experience, definitely not the experience of Patricia. But the brand had become, I mean, Patricia was making nice clothes, very nice clothes for women who wore to work, you know. And I think Robert's mindset was like, we need to get back to the spirit and the whimsy of what Perry Ellis once was. So he chose me, and I couldn't say no.
Carrie Donovan, another legendary fashion editor, famous for those iconic round glasses.
And the New York Times Magazine, Fashion of the Times.
The collection everyone knows is grunge, but can you tell me about the first one you did for Perry Ellis?
So the first collection for Perry Ellis, I mean, I got a lot of hell for that too. It was a very weird time at Vogue. Grace Mirabella had just been let go, and Anna took the job of, you know, editor-in-chief. And Anna was a big team Marc Jacobs. She had come to some of my shows when she was at HG, right? Somehow, we had this sort of connection. And so she had championed me and supported me before she came to Vogue. And when I showed my first show for Perry Ellis, it was a lot of these little bucket hats in satin and odd materials, velvet. And all of the girls had like a bob. It wasn't meant to be an homage to Anna, but of course that's how everyone read it. And it was very kind of, well, at the time I felt it had like the spirit of Perry. It had, you know, we did these American flag cashmere blankets in crazy colors like bubblegum pink with ochre yellow. And the girls were wrapped in them. And there was like such sort of spirit in the colors and the shapes and everything. And Anna applauded it. But then there were all these old school friends of the House of Perry, which included maybe, you know, some of the Mirabella crew and some of these other people. And they just thought I was a heretic because I had taken this brand that they felt they owned, or not owned, but, you know, they were on a different, they were in a different place. So they didn't like that I was there or what I was doing there. But then you had like this new guard who was like saying, yeah, this is exactly what we need, you know. So it was one of those moments. And that was 3 years before the actual grunge show.
So, I mean, it's the whole subject coming up again of this generational change. And when it happens in fashion, it can be quite jarring for the people who've been around.
Well, I think the thing is, again, it's like going back to my shrink in this discussion, is that somehow we're all smart enough to know that change occurs. But there's also something maybe in some of us that thinks, well, of course change is going to happen, but it won't affect me, or it won't happen to me, or something.
Talking about the grunge collection, though, did you anticipate the reaction that it would cause? Did you welcome it?
So there were some seasons at Perry Ellis where I got my hand slapped after the first one, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do what I guess they expect of me, which is clothes more for women, like the ladies who lunch. Like, I somehow thought that my position needed to look more like Bill Blass than like Marc Jacobs. I don't know why, but that's what I did. And I did that for a couple of seasons, and then I was like, I can't do this. It's like, it doesn't feel good and I'm not enjoying it and it doesn't seem like to be working or whatever. And so we did a collection called the Rock and Roll Circus, or that I named the Rock and Roll Circus. And then I felt like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to do top hats and lizard pants and, you know, tailcoats. And I want to have fun and make noise. So that was that. And that led, and then I felt so good about that, that pursuit of the grunge collection and responding to what I was really loving in photography from Corinne Day, David Sims, Jürgen Teller, the music of Courtney Love, of Sonic Youth, of Kurt Cobain, you know, all of that was what I was loving. And there were, I mean, and I had friends who looked like that, you know, and I just thought, like, this is what I want to do. I want to respond to what I really feel and what I really love. And that was grunge. So that, I mean, that's how that came about. And did I think it was going to have the response it did? No, I think I just thought like people are going to like it or they're not going to like it. But I didn't think it would be such a topic of conversation or of such interest, you know?
Your job was terminated at Perry Ellis. Did you think it was the end of your career? I mean, go back to that moment. How did it feel?
Well, I actually wasn't terminated right after the grunge collection. I mean, it was shortly after. I did start working on another season, but then they decided to discontinue the women's collections. I mean, I have no shame around the idea of being fired for the grunge. I think it actually makes it better. You know, like, oh, you were fired, you were let go because it was such a disgrace. I mean, that sounds so much better than probably what really happened. But I didn't know what was going to happen. I remember talking to Robert and thinking like, well, what are we going to do next? And we had a non-compete thing, so we weren't allowed to work for a year. But then we also got this financial settlement and we decided to open a store. And both Robert and I were like, this is what we love to do. So we just have to find a way to do it again, you know? And then I started doing a consulting job. He mortgaged his house. We had the settlement money from Perry Ellis. So we opened the store in Mercer Street, which we couldn't actually open because we had no money left to make clothes. So that was kind of a funny backwards way of doing things.
It was a great store. And very quickly, in a matter of years, there's another major milestone. You get appointed to Louis Vuitton, and a big job because Louis Vuitton had never had ready-to-wear.
Mm.
And you did the unexpected, you could even say iconoclastic thing of your first show, showing practically no handbags, right?
One. Yeah, I mean, that was amazing to get that job. And I mean, it would be very difficult to explain all the feelings that came up and all the fear. And that first collection, yeah, I felt like I couldn't win. You know, if I did what people expected, meaning covered everything in the monogram, then they'd be disappointed because they got what they expected. And if I didn't do what they expected, then they'd be disappointed that I didn't give them what they wanted. So I just thought I was screwed, you know. And also there was no archive to look at. There was no nothing. There was so I did a lot of like mental masturbation, and I was like, what is it really about? What is Louis Vuitton? What is the essence of Louis Vuitton? And I came up with this idea that really what it is this monogram, and if I celebrate it, then that will be good. That will be what people want. But that first season, I was adamant about not doing it. So, you know, all the monogram was inside a white bonded cotton raincoat or underneath the buttons, so you couldn't see it.
You know, trying to put myself back in that moment, I think what I felt was, you know, you made Louis Vuitton cool. Like, it didn't have a sense of coolness for people in fashion. It was an established brand, a legacy brand. It was for old rich people, is how I felt when in my 20s, you know? And suddenly it was something that we all wanted.
Yeah. Mr. Arnault, I mean, I just completely, you know, owe it all to him, really. And he trusted me with this huge brand, even though the people who he had put into these, you know, very big positions were not necessarily happy with his choice of me to do this. They weren't happy with the idea of ready-to-wear. They weren't happy with the idea of change. They weren't happy with an American, a young American designer coming in and deciding what this future would look like. But I remember, you know, as I struggled with some of these obstacles and people, you know, I'd once in a while have lunch with Mr. Arnault, and he'd say, like, don't worry about them. I hired you for what I believe you can bring. And if you know, just don't worry about them. Just do your thing. And I think I did the first thing that I did that gained like some recognition and commercial success was what I called monogram vernis. And my idea was to, you know, use the monogram embossed so that you see it and don't see it, and to bring a new surface. Like, everything was so dull and a bit masculine and coloring at Vuitton. So I thought this was the way to do color, shine, monogram, you know. And he was impressed by it, Mr. Arnault, and he took one of the bags home to show his wife, and she thought it was very attractive, which was a good sign. And so they went with it, and that was a big success. And I think that helped me to build confidence about introducing things that were not expected. So then I invited Stephen Sprouse to come and deface the monogram with graffiti, which the powers there were like, this is not allowed. You cannot touch the monogram. And I didn't listen. I just did it and, like, sent it out, and to their horror. And, of course, there were waiting lists for bags, you know, and they'd never experienced that before in their whole career.
I remember those, too, so clearly. I sometimes see other editors carrying their vintage pieces on the airplanes to the shows.
Yeah.
So talking about longevity.
Yeah.
And you, of course, had other collaborators at Vuitton, too.
Yes.
Takashi Murakami,
yes,
being the Japanese artist, Richard Prince, mm-hmm, the American artist.
Yayoi Kusama also.
Right.
Yeah. The whole collaboration thing is a topic that people are always interested in hearing from me on, because I think now we live in a time where this idea of collaboration is like so mainstream. But at the time where I invited Stephen in or Takashi in, it was, I romanticized my position at Louis Vuitton. I was constantly thinking, what does it mean that I'm here, you know? And I thought, my name's not on the door. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And what should I be doing? And I thought of myself, this New Yorker in Paris, and I thought, like, wow, when I think about the history of fashion and I think about Coco Chanel and I think about Schiaparelli, who were two of my heroes, I think they were always collaborating with Jean Cocteau or Picasso on a set or all this. And I thought that was a magical time where people who were in creative positions, they didn't even think of it as collaborating. They gravitated towards each other and they made things together and they had ideas and I just thought, like, oh, that's what I'm going to do at Vuitton. I'm going to use my role here as a way to bring in other creatives that I can make things with.
Coco Chanel and Elsa Schiaparelli were two of your heroes, you said. Did you know about them at a young age? How did you sort of start understanding that you were interested in fashion?
I knew I loved clothes, and I knew I was excited when I got back to school clothes. And I think, I mean, there must have been some movies where I loved what the women were wearing. I mean, I definitely, at an early age, saw, you know, adult movies that, I mean, I don't mean adult as in porn. That was later. I saw costumes. I mean, whether it was Jane Fonda in Clute and a brown Norelle sequin dress, you know, like I didn't know that it was Norelle. But as I got interested in Liza Minnelli in Cabaret or Barbra Streisand in Hello Dolly, now this is like the gayest list ever, but or Judy Garland, I mean, perfect gay list, or Marlene Dietrich, all those iconic women. Then I found out, or Mae West, and finding out like, oh, it was Schiaparelli who did this dress for Mae West, and it was so-and-so who made this dress for Jane Fonda, you know, and then I had such a huge appetite for anything fashion.
You lived with your paternal grandmother when you were a teenager. Did she have magazines around? Was she interested in fashion?
Well, okay, so she was very interested in fashion. She didn't, I wouldn't say she had magazines around, but she did shop at Bergdorf and Saks and Lord & Taylor, Baum & Taylor. A lot of these places are no longer around, but Saks is, Bergdorf's is for sure. but my grandmother loved to get dressed, and she, even if it was to go to the corner to go to the butcher and the supermarket, it didn't matter. She spent her time and had her process and her rituals and routines.
We've talked a lot about aging and the challenges.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, it's something I think about every day. What do you think is the best part?
I don't know that I'm fully there in terms of, I mean, I certainly accept it. I mean, look, I'm alive, I'm well, I'm healthy, I have wonderful people in my life. I'm working on a house and making it just into this beautiful place, and I get to work in fashion, which I love, still love, with a group of incredible, talented people. So there's so much good, right? And I've started really enjoying quiet time and calm time. I mean, it's very unusual for me. I am really getting pleasure out of doing things like reading a book in quiet, or waking up and having a coffee and seeing the sunrise. And it all sounds so cliche. And even as I describe it, it's like, oh, that is so old. Like, you know what I mean? You are so old. You're like watching the sunrise and reading a book in the afternoon and getting, you know, going to bed early. It's like, oh my God. As I say it, I'm just laughing.
Speaking of reading, because I see you posting on Instagram reading, what are you reading now?
I just started Our Lady of the Flowers by Jean Genet.
Mm. Enjoying it?
I'm actually on the introduction by Sartre, so I'm not sure. It's already a bit of a trip, but I'm sure I'll get into it.
And anything that you've read in the last few months that you really liked?
So many books I've read. I read Myra Breckinridge by Gore Vidal. I read Answered Prayers by Truman Capote. I read The Swimming Pool Library. I read, I've read so many books. Oh, I read The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. A lot of books.
Well, since you mentioned Truman Capote, you have to tell us what you think of The Swan so far.
Well, I love Ryan Murphy and I love what he does. I think the actor's name is Tom Hollander, who's playing Truman Capote. Mm-hmm. He is phenomenal to watch. When he's on the screen, I really enjoy it. I am enjoying the series because I love the subject matter. You know, I just watched episode 2 last night. I went to the premiere for the first episode and, you know, I love Gus Van Sant as a director. I mean, there's so much to love in this for me. So that's my opinion.
Yes. Babe Paley's dress in the scene that's shot in Bodega Bay where they're in Jamaica, I think. That one really got me. I can't wait to see the black and white ball.
Yeah, the black and white ball is always a good thing.
Do you watch anything else on TV these days that you like?
My favorite show in the world is Love on the Spectrum, which is the life and dating life of people who are on the autism spectrum. And I've never seen anything that just, I mean, it moves me to tears every time, every one of the people. So, and that just had a new season. So we kind of binge watched it. And then in a night, it's great. And then I watch some trashy TV like Love Island or 90 Day Fiancé. You know, when I can't bear to like think about anything, those are the two go-tos. Mm-hmm.
And so tell us about a normal day. You wake up to watch the sunrise.
Yeah, or the rainfall. A normal day. So since I've been living in this house, my normal day is waking up. I go make coffee and or espresso, and I take it either over to the window or to watch the fish. I have two fish now, and I had a few more, but unfortunately some of them didn't make it. And I love sitting and having my coffee and watching these very playful Oranda is the breed of fish I have, and or sitting and watching the sunrise, and usually Lady, who's our dog, she comes up and joins me, whether I'm watching the fish or I'm on the couch watching the sunrise. And then I get showered and ready for my day, which typically involves, if I'm working, it typically involves a commute into the city, which I never had to experience before, now that I live out there in Rye. Commuting, working, or doing things like this. And then I think I have Bergdorf Goodman this afternoon. Then I will sit in traffic for a while as I commute home, watch some TV or read or both, and then go to bed.
What do you do on your commute? Do you listen to podcasts or?
So I think I'll probably get to the point of listening to podcasts, but actually I really love the quiet and I meditate. I practice transcendental meditation. So I do two meditations a day, and one, the car is the perfect thing, you know, because you're sitting up, your feet are on the ground. I mean, it's like you couldn't be more like open and connected in some way.
Have you meditated for a long time?
On and off. I'm in a program for, you know, recovery, and meditation and prayer are very important parts of that recovery. And I do both of those things religiously every day. And it's working out pretty well for me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a good therapy session to start the day.
Well, thank you, Mark Jacobs, for being here. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Nicole.
All right, that's it for today's episode. See you next week.
Bye.
The Run Through with Vogue is a production of Condé Nast. The show is produced by Susie Lechtenberg, Chelsea Daniel, and Alex John Burns, with engineering from Jake Loomis, Gabe Quiroga, and James Yost. It is mixed by Mike Kutchman. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.